This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to another edition of the MLB Pipeline Podcast. I'm Jason Ratliff here with Jim Callis and Jonathan Mayo. The season is underway. Wow, our first in-season episode of the year. Now, I guess when I say the season is underway, that's true for the major leagues and AAA, not yet as we record this for the levels below AAA. They get underway this week as well, so we're excited about that. I think that opening day ranked second in Jim and Jonathan's power rankings of the three opening days last week when we did this. So we're going to talk about some of the happenings at AAA over the course of the first few days of that season and the first week of the major league season. A lot of rookies to watch, a lot of big time prospects in the big leagues making their debuts. Jonathan has just returned from the National High School Invitational at the USA Baseball Complex out in Cary, North Carolina. We'll talk about that, and in particular we are going to have a conversation with Noble Meyer. Jonathan was able to sit down with him at the NHSI. He is the top-ranked high school pitching prospect in this year's draft class. Now, we'll talk a little bit more about the NHSI, some of the top performers out there, and we want to talk about a nice little matchup we had in college baseball. Really, really nice pitching matchup. Skeens versus Dolander. And then we'll wrap up by answering a question from the mailbag. The return of the Lizard King is what we're looking forward to there. All right, guys. Season is underway. As I said, you guys ranked the three opening days last week. I think you were both most excited for Major League Baseball opening day. And right off the bat, we had excitement from our top two prospects who are making their Major League debuts. Of course, the top two prospects in baseball, Gunnar Henderson and Corbin Carroll. They debuted last year, but opened up the season on opening day rosters again this year. But then we had Jordan Walker of the Cardinals and Anthony Volpe of the Yankees, both making their debuts on opening day. And right off the bat, we had Walker, you know, lining a shot. He's had several 105 plus mile an hour exit velocities in the early going. He unleashed a 100-mile-an-hour throw from the outfield, which is the hardest throw ever recorded by StatCast by a Cardinals outfielder. We've seen him put down 29 feet per second sprint speeds, which is bordering on elite speed, which for a 6'5", 250-pound guy is pretty impressive. And then Volpe has stolen three bases in the first three games, which has happened only a handful of times in baseball history.
Five times, Jason.
Five times.
Since 1901.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, right off the bat, we saw these guys creating excitement, and that's fun, right? I mean, we knew these guys were going to be exciting, and we got it right off the bat.
Yeah, you know what's interesting to me? I mean, you know, it's small sample size, but both these guys, you know, a lot of times when prospects get to the big leagues, they try to do too much, especially if you're a hyped up prospect. And these two guys are hyped up as much as anybody. And they're both just doing what got them there. I mean, they don't have eye popping numbers. You know, Jordan Walker, who I think has maybe the most usable power of anybody on our top 100 prospects list, doesn't have a home run yet, just one extra base hit. But he's also only struck out one time in 17 plate appearances, and he's been the Jordan Walker we saw a ton of in the fall league, and we saw the same thing in spring training, where he's 6'5", 250. He knows he doesn't have to try to hit home runs. The ball jumps off his bat. You know, like you were saying, Jason, he hits the ball very hard, and he just focuses on making contact and driving the ball from gap to gap, and the home runs are going to come. And then Volpe, who's only 2 for 11, but he's walked more than he struck out. He, you know, stole bases in his first three games. The last guy to do that in each of his first three big league games was Billy Hamilton 10 years ago. And, you know, Volpe, you know, he's doing what impressed the Yankees in spring training. Like if he's not getting pitches to hit, he draws walks and he makes things happen on the bases. And that's one of the oldest lineups in baseball. And I think his energy and just, you know, constant nonstop motor are going to be a nice addition to that lineup. And again, you know, it's not like those guys are, you know, nobody's off to a Stephen Kwan start and nobody's hit, you know, three home runs or anything, but both those guys just seem like they're very comfortable in their own skin, which is, I think, been our impression of them throughout their careers. And even though there's, you know, they're in the glare of the spotlight more than ever, they're still comfortable and just doing what they do best.
Yeah, I think it's important for Volpe especially to not worry about some of the counting stats and things like that. And, you know, I'm sure he's being reminded that he's contributing in a number of ways, and it's so early that you're not going to extrapolate too much. I thought about Jason asking you if you were worried about Jordan Walker's lack of power, but I think Jim just sort of covered it there.
Yeah. It's funny, right? Like he's this guy who since the draft has been known, you know, most for his power tool. He's, you know, not that he's, you know, not a good hitter, his hit tool 55, but power tool of 65. And we really haven't seen that power yet. And you have to think there's no way it doesn't come. And it's funny. I just noticed, I said he was 6'5", 250 earlier. And I heard him during spring training say that he was 250. So I believe that, but he'd been listed, on the site as 6'5", 220. I believe, or maybe 225, but now it's been updated just within the past few days. Must be he's listed as 6'6" and 245. So I don't know. Maybe he's on that O'Neal Cruz track where he was.
Well, he's still just 20. He could still be growing. He's still just 20.
Yeah.
I think it's going to be. And listen, we'll see what he settles into. But you know, if you look back at Aaron Judge's numbers in the minors. And I'm not making, you know, I don't like comps, but he did not hit for a ton of power in the minor leagues. I don't know that anyone knew he was going to hit 60 homers, but everyone knew there was power there. He didn't even hit a ton of power in college. So I think there are some similarities there where, you know, I think it's great. Let him establish the hit tool. And as Jim pointed out, he's not tried to do too much, and he never has. Like, that power is going to come.
All right. First pipeline pop quiz of the day for you guys.
Wow, early.
Yep.
Go.
There are more to come. Which rookie has the most total bases in the big leagues so far? I'll give you a hint. He is not on the top 100 prospects.
Yeah, I was going to say, you wouldn't be asking if it were somebody obvious.
He's been hard to get out, man.
Well, my boy, no. James Altman.
Come on now.
11 total bases. Corbin Carroll. Has 10 so far.
I was going to guess Bryce Terang.
Bryce Terang has 9. Alec Burleson has 9.
Your terrible joke there is it's not the first time I've heard that. When I was at a fall league game and I saw James Altman play great that whole fall league a couple of years ago, John DiAquisto, the former big league pitcher who's a clock operator now, a lot of the fall league games, made the exact same joke about like what a terrible name it is for a hitter. And I was like, no, he's pretty good. And then he homered, I think, his first at bat that night. So. And made like some spectacular catch. I think that was also one of the nights, Jonathan, where I saw Ezekiel Tovar. Like I saw all of his three good games in the fall league that fall, and that was one of them. And I think Altman robbed him at the wall late in the game. But
say you have no memory.
I James Altman is one of my favorite non-top 100 prospects, and I guess he won't be a prospect for much longer. But just I'll give the short for it. But you know, here's a guy who didn't even hit 250 in 3 years of college. And he had good tools, and the Dodgers felt like they could help him make some adjustments to his swing. And it took a couple years, and it's taken, and he's been really good the last two or three years. Had one of the best seasons of anybody in AAA last year, and now helping the Dodgers. I mean, he's super talented. He's going to be one of those guys who's, you know, going to wind up being an all-star down the road, and we're going to be like, why wasn't that guy ever on the top 100 prospects list? But he's talented.
Is he close? I know you guys... You guys have put together sort of the next up list, and I confess to having not looked at that yet.
How dare you?
Is he Is he? I know. I think there are some other Dodgers. That
Dalton Rushing's ahead of him on our Dodgers list, yeah. And Altman is 20, or he's going to be 26 in May. So he's older. You know, between the pandemic and being a college guy and all that. So my guess is he'd probably graduate before we got to him. Although I did have somebody within the Dodgers organization make the point, and they weren't bagging on Michael Busch, who is on our top 100 prospects list, but they're like, look, I mean, they had basically the same year in AAA. You can argue Altman's year was better, and he brings a ton more base running and defensive value.
Same age.
You know, Altman might be better than Michael Busch. And I was like, huh, I hadn't really thought about that. But, you know, this guy was making a case. It wasn't like this guy was anti-Michael Busch, but Michael Busch, you know, has that first-round pedigree, and, you know, he'll be 26 later in the year. I mean, he's, what, about half a year younger than Altman. But, you know, he plays second base. He's probably a fringy second baseman, which is an accomplishment in itself because nobody really thought he could play second. But it's, yeah, I mean, I think Altman's flown under the radar, too, because he wasn't a high-pedigree guy, and he really didn't start taking off till, I guess it was, you know, the second half of 2020. I mean 2021. And then got going, but he's a really talented player. Like, that's what everybody, you know, I'm sure the other teams in NL West are saying, this is great. We really need the Dodgers, you know, finding, you know, turning a seventh rounder into a very good big leaguer.
All right. Earlier mentioned that Volpe is 3-for-3 in stolen bases, as is Corbin Carroll. Pipeline pop quiz number 2. Carroll has 2 of the 15 fastest sprint speeds recorded so far this year, which is no surprise. 2 other players have 2 or more. Trey Turner has the 1st and 3rd fastest sprint speeds recorded this year. Who has the most of the top 15 sprint speeds? One player has 4 of them.
And it's a prospect.
It is not a prospect, but he recently was.
Do you understand?
As of last year.
This podcast?
As of last year, and I think the reason it's pertinent is because he was one of, if not the top prospect in baseball. Not exactly known for, and I don't think he's most known for his blazing speed.
Oh, Julio Rodriguez?
No, Bobby Witt Jr.
Bobby Witt Jr.?
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. Garrett Mitchell also has 3 of the top 31 sprint speeds recorded so far. So
I thought you were going to really impress us and tell us it was Adley Rutschman. I was going to be like, what?
No, you guys got bagged on a little bit for Adley's run grade, if I remember correctly. Especially when he came out and his first hit was a triple, and he, I think, had pretty decent sprint speed. And yeah, we got some people yapping about his.
I hope that came up in Jonathan's review. When you
do you remember what Adley's run grade was? I think it was pretty low.
I can't imagine it was lower than like a 40.
I thought I made him a 40, but maybe I didn't.
No. And the thing is that's tough is like there's so many different ways to measure speed. Like when you're at the ballpark, the only real way you can measure speed, the only time you get the guy running in a straight line all out, and it's not always all out, is home to first.
30.
Yeah, and home to first. Terrible, Jonathan. Home to first. You should make a $25,000 donation to Adley's favorite charity or something. But but like, you know, the home to first time isn't necessarily a really reflective measurement of a guy's speed, because guys get quicker. There's guys who have a quick first step. There's guys who have swings that take them toward first base quickly. There's other guys who have big swings that slow them down coming out of the box and they're faster underway. Like the speed scores, I think in general, are a mess.
Yeah, it's good. I mean, it's good when these guys get to the big leagues, and now we see it in AAA, and we have StatCast on these guys, and you can, you know, get some actual data on sprint speeds, and, you know, not just home to first times, but, you know, you can see home to second, home to third times where they're actually going all out on doubles and triples, and easier to have some real data to look at there.
I think Miguel Vargas of the Dodgers, who's another guy who's not considered very fast, when he made his big league debut last year.
That's the one, right?
I think his sprint speeds were in like the 92nd percentile. And so it's like, what's going on here? So it's just like you can get totally different measurements of how fast a guy is depending on how you're doing it.
On the topic of speed, Pipeline Pop Quiz number 3.
Man.
Sandra Bullock.
Very nice. I see what you did there.
What's the overall success rate so far stolen bases in the big leagues?
84%.
Oh,
I read it this morning.
Oh, really?
I did. I was reading an article. Wow, like somebody's one of these newsletters you get in the morning, somebody had 84%. So
that's it. And do you know how many total attempts there have been?
It seems like around 100.
We're exactly at 100. 84 for 100.
Even I could do that math.
Rookies are a perfect 14 for 14 in stolen bases. I mean, have we gone too far? Is it too easy to steal bases now?
Well, we're four games into the season too. I think it could be one of these things.
You think adjustments will be made?
Yeah. Like teams are going to have to address this more than they realized.
Do you think the prospects are having that much success because they've played with these newfangled rules before?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I think the prospects we're running are also just
fast.
Yeah, right. Carroll and Volpe. But yeah. All right, let's move down a notch to AAA. We've only had, as we're recording this, they've only played three games so far. But early on, another pipeline pop quiz. Who leads the minors or AAA in total bases among ranked prospects right now?
Brett Beatty.
A fine guess. He's tied for second with another guy that you might guess.
I was looking at this earlier. I know the answer.
Was this in your newsletter?
No, but I was looking at it when we were doing podcast prep. Former top 100 prospect, right?
Yep.
Like Jonathan, again, ranked criminally low. Jonathan, terrible job by you. Number 17 on your Rockies list, Nolan Jones.
Yep, Nolan Jones.
How could you not see this coming?
I love Nolan Jones.
He's good interview. I remember talking hockey with him because he was a hockey player
in Cleveland. His
brother was a goalie. Player. He's a good guy. But yep. But anyway, I was looking at it earlier. So Nolan Jones.
Is there? Do we have a resurgence here?
Based on three games, he's on pace for 120 homer season,
right?
In AAA.
It's not a hitter friendly place.
I will say
at home, by the way.
I always had him in the Guardian system, and I do think the power is real. I do think the patience is real. And, you know, they had a bunch of young players and it just didn't come together for him in Cleveland. I think he's a perfect change of scenery guy.
Yep.
Perfect guy for the Rockies to take a chance on and see what he could. I mean, the power is real. It's just going to be consistency. I don't think he's ever going to be a huge, you know, high average guy, but I do think he'll draw walks. So, when we do market adjustments, we'll have to run Nolan Jones back up the list. We'll see.
Yeah, you guessed Beatty. He's tied for second with Bo Naylor. And then Soderstrom has 11 total bases. Samad Taylor has 11 total bases. Soderstrom hit a massive home run over the weekend, 466 feet. I think the exit velocity was 113.5 miles an hour, something like that. Beatty has had several of the hardest hit balls at AAA so far. And Beatty, I know, Jim, you were none too pleased that he didn't start the year in the big leagues. And I mean, you know, I know the Mets said that he needed to check off some boxes and he seemed
No. The Mets cited what ticked me off. Their excuse was ridiculous. They start ticking off how many games Nolan Arenado and Austin Riley played in the minors without even adjusting for the fact that Brett Beatty had the pandemic year. But I mean, the guy should be on the Mets. It's somewhat antiquated thinking, but he had options remaining. Other guys didn't. So we don't want to, you know, possibly lose like a 4A type player instead of playing Brett Beatty who can hit. I will not forgive the Mets for that one. It's foolish. Brett Beatty should be in the big leagues. He should be in the big leagues. That's all I have to say.
Made a nice play at third the other day. He's looked good all around. Anyone else in the pitching has been rough early on for ranked prospects.
I do have one more thing to say. I was wrong. Eduardo Escobar is 1 for 16 in the big leagues. I know it's small sample size. I believe Brett Beatty could go 1 for 16 in the big leagues also and strike out nearly half his at bats if that's what the Mets are looking for.
We're already starting to get questions about when Beatty's going to get called up and
Anyway, sorry. I'll stop stumping for Brett Beatty now.
On the other side of the ball, highest ranked, just about every ranked prospect first time out had a rough go. Grayson, Taj, Gavin Stone, Brandon Fott kind of looked like he was picking up right where he left off last year when he struck out 218 batters, most in 21 years in the minors, and struck out three in the first inning. I think ended up with seven over four or five innings, whatever it was. But
also two thirds.
Is that what, 3 2/3?
Yep.
Yikes. Gave up four home runs. But a few good outings. Matthew Liberatore, Silseth, and then one in the big leagues in Johnny Brito, who looked good. Liberatore was, I think he touched 99, maybe?
It's kind of funny with him because it feels like he's been around forever.
It does.
He's 23. Like, I know the stuff backed up. I hadn't seen what the velo was in the start. Again, one start. But certainly an encouraging beginning. I'm still on board with him. I think he's going to be a big league starter. I think he got rushed a little bit, but he's 23 and pitched really well. And then Chase Silseth of the Angels, the first guy from the 2021 draft to make it to the big leagues at all, part of the Angels, all pitching draft. Like, good to see him because he got roughed up when he was in the big leagues last year, but was dominant in Double A. Now, Triple A, and he's kind of doing the same thing that he did. He's throwing a lot of strikes. The stuff has always been good, but the command has been so much better. And he's added a cutter, and he's only 22. There's still plenty of time for both of those guys, even though for different times and different reasons, calls up to the big leagues. But, Libertard, there's definite fatigue. But, I still think he can figure it out.
When I was in Cardinals camp, they were very enthused by how Libertor was pitching this spring. He was throwing harder, and they just thought he was pitching with more assertiveness. I think when he got knocked around in AAA, he's been knocked around in AAA for 2 years, and he got knocked around in the big leagues, and he'd fall behind the count. I don't think he trusted a lot of pitches from talking to the Cardinals beyond that curveball that he's always had. And they just liked the way he was attacking hitters more. He was going after guys with his fastball. He's throwing a little bit harder. He's using his slider a little bit more to give guys a harder, look with the breaking ball. So, we'll see if he bounces back. It's weird. It feels weird not having him on the top 100 prospects list, because I think he was pretty much a mainstay on that list since they drafted him back in 2018. But he's a guy who they were very encouraged by how he looked this spring.
All right. Let's take a break, come back, and listen to Jonathan's interview with the top-ranked high school pitching prospect in this year's draft class, Noble Meyer. That's coming up next on the MLB Pipeline Podcast.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24/7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Welcome back to the MLB Pipeline Podcast. Jonathan Mayo here in Cary, North Carolina, USA Baseball's National Training Complex. And the National High School Invitational is winding down here, recording this on a Friday when they decided to stack up 15 games in one day. I'm here with most people believe is the top high school arm in this year's draft class, Noble Meyer. Noble, thanks for taking some time.
Of course, thank you.
So, first and foremost, this is obviously a team event. I know things probably haven't gone exactly the way you guys would have hoped, but as someone who has been here before for more, on the individual showcase side, how much fun has it been to just be at this facility and compete with the guys that you compete with all year?
I mean, it's awesome. I mean, this is a trip we've been looking forward to and really like bonded over these games together. I mean, we win together, we lose together, gotten a lot closer. Yeah, it is a lot different from the event like PDP where you're kind of there for yourself, you get matched with a bunch of players you've never met before, but this is like you have your whole family together.
And you have a lot more support in the stands. There's a little more electricity here, I think, than there is over the summer.
Absolutely, yeah.
Are there things that you think that you guys collectively took from here, you know, even if it doesn't show up in the win column, that you can take back to your schedule when you're back home?
I think really competing. I mean, we have a very, very, very good team. And to see some great competition like this really showing us how to compete, especially when we're losing. Like, I mean, that's not something that happens to us often. Really understanding how to climb back and really fight to win a game.
I think, you know, when you learn to lose as a team, that usually can mean some special things down the road.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, learning what losing feels like really can help us propel to not want to lose anymore, I guess.
We talked a little bit after your start on, when was that? Wednesday?
Yeah.
Wednesday. The days blur together here. Obviously, personally, you threw extremely well. You had a little time to reflect now a couple days later as opposed to right after the game when we spoke the first time. What were some of your takeaways from your start against Calvary Christian?
I mean, that's a game that I felt like I come out of that seventh inning and I never wanted to win a game more than that. I mean, tried to build up my team and we had let up three runs in the sixth. It's just, I mean, errors happen. Things are going to go that way. But I mean, I come back in, I'm firing my team up. I start off the bottom of the sixth, the walk, get on base, try to start a rally. So what? I mean, that's a great team on the other end too. I know Morota's through heck of a game, shut that out. Dietz with an amazing outing. I mean, that's quality baseball versus quality baseball. So I think all in all, that's a great game, both sides.
You told me that you felt that all of your stuff was working pretty well. The one thing that you said, and I get the sense that you can be pretty self-critical, just
a little bit, yeah.
Was your fastball command. Obviously it wasn't terrible. I mean, people look at the stat line, they're going to be like, what is he talking about? But like, what did you think, you know, what were you thinking that was quite often, and what was there any particular reason for it?
I mean, looking back, I mean, I threw out, 101 pitches through seven innings. That's about 15 pitches per inning-ish, a little more than that.
Yeah.
That's really good. But yeah, a little self-critical on that. I think first inning, didn't get a couple inside calls, and then just worked mostly outside and up a little farther towards the plate on the inside pitches, I guess. I maybe just had a memory of missing one or two pretty bad and kind of stuck with me. But I think I spotted a fastball as well and where I wanted to. Sliders were outside corner. Curveballs all stayed competitive. I think it was quality pitch after quality pitch.
I want to talk about the breaking balls in a little bit. One thing you also mentioned to me was that you felt the life on your fastball was good. Is that something that you felt was an area that you needed to address a little bit? Because I have heard from scouts, obviously fastball velocity wise, mm-hmm. plenty good, especially for your age, projection, things like that. But how it's going to play at the next level, is that something that you've recognized that you need to address a little bit?
Kind of. Little minor change that I made this offseason. I had a little issue with cutting the ball. And it really just stemmed from my initial movement with my leg kick and starting to drift. Arm gets a little late around the ball. I was really focused on keeping that back leg stacked and then staying on top of the ball. Really get that extra ride and carry on the fastball. I got a lot more swings and misses than I normally do. And then having bat play that well up really expands the arsenal with slider and curveball, allows me to play off that more.
All right, let's talk about the two breaking balls. I mean, I saw you over the summer. Mm-hmm. I don't think you were throwing the curve.
Not at all.
Right. You said it was something that you used to throw, like, because I guess every kid, when they mm-hmm. first learn a breaking ball, yep. they're going to learn a curveball. Take me through the sort of the process of adding that in, mm. because, you know, fastball, slider, changeup, all pretty good pitches. Mm-hmm. Sure, let's add a fourth one when you're a high school senior. You know, what was the decision making behind that?
So when I was about a sophomore, I was strictly fastball curve and then a probably below average changeup. And then I realized slider would probably fit my arm slot better, and I found a grip that was comfortable to me. It's a little unorthodox. And then I just worked slider, fastball, and then occasional change, still a little under below average. And my primary focus was I gotta get that changeup better, because that'll be my weapon against lefty, breaks away from them, and maybe Sunday I'll be good against righties too. But as I developed, I realized I'd only have two pitches versus each side, and that's like, you can eliminate one if one's off, and then they're just sitting on one pitch. And I realized I can go back to that curveball grip. It's a little different than what it used to be, but I mean, I spin it really well, feels comfortable, worked all off season to really get that super comfortable in my hand, be able to land it, be able to spike it. And I think it's made really big progress, and it's a really good pitch right now.
It's too bad this is an audio medium, yeah, because it keeps showing me the grip. But I think that, you know, the one fear, you know, with a young pitcher is when you start throwing distinct breaking balls that, you know,
blend together
things like that. Has that happened to you at all? Is that something that you've been pretty pleased that you've been able to keep separate? I know the other night, those were two very distinct pitches.
Mm-hmm. There's some days in some bullpens where I'll see that the break on both pitches are pretty, or the difference between the break on both pitches is pretty minimal. But usually I'm able to keep my slider around 13, 14 inches of horizontal and 0 inches of vert. So that's pretty much a sweeper. And the curveball usually is around like 14 and 15, respectively. More of like a, turns into kind of a sweeper, but it's a separate pitch in itself. And the speed differential too is different too.
Yeah. Now, and people can't see this, but I'm assuming because of what you showed me, you throw a circle change?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, is there any fear that, like, all right, I've added this curveball in now? Like, we talked about you only threw two changeups the other day. Like, you know you're going to need that changeup.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a fear that, like, you're not going to work on that enough because you have the three other pitches?
No. I mean, fastball, slider, curveball, I mean, that's what works in games typically. And then I'll bring out the changeup when I face lefties. But in bullpens, behind the scenes, like, I'm heavy changeups, working that all the time, because I think pronation, like keeping that pronation, then can't really see it, but keeping the pronation is huge. Really expands, like, comes from a forearm mobility and wrist mobility, allows you to work both ways, supination and pronation. But I mean, I probably throw around 45% changeups in my bullpens.
And to me, this is fascinating. I feel like this has happened more and more, and you probably talk to other pitchers at your level, but your combination of talking about data, talking about sort of the biomechanics of what you do. When was there a certain point that you sort of recognized that your brain can take in all that information? I would imagine sometimes, like, you have to shut that off and just go and throw with all that information to back you up.
I mean, I'm a child of two engineers, so it's kind of woven into my brain. But when I was a freshman, I used to throw my fastball almost like a splitter, like my pointer finger and middle finger were both very far apart, and I got on like a high speed camera, got on Rapsodo, all that, and that's when I like really learned, okay, this is super interesting to me, and this is also something I can use to like advance my game. And I just kind of fell in love with it from there, and like I study all that, like Pitching Ninja, stuff like all those kind of things, TrackMan, Rapsodo. Like, I'll watch all the spin rates and just kind of fell in love with it.
And do you have to turn your brain off sometimes? Because if you're, you know, sometimes guys who are, you know, kind of cerebral think too much on the mound.
What's really helped me is I just think of one thing at a time. Usually that stems into keeping my mechanics all right. Like, it changes from time to time. Like, most recently, my main focus is keep my back leg planted, don't let myself drift, and allow myself to give myself time, my mechanics, to get my arm upright and release from there. But like this past summer, it was just getting my hand separate, getting to a stronger position earlier, getting a 90 degree pointing up as quick as I can in my delivery. But I mean, when I'm in bullpens, I'll think about all these stats and spin rates, and I try to see when I change a little tiny thing, what changes on the day on the data, and work from that. But when I get in game, it's just I'm focused on winning the game, and that really that's it.
Now, you are not the first big right-hander to come from Jesuit, who's mm-hmm. you know, a first-round killer. Mick Abel, is he like, is he a role model? Is there like a shrine to him? Do you want to be better than him? Tell me, like, the fact that he's gone through what you're hopefully about to go through, how has that helped you in this process?
So unfortunately, he was a senior in my freshman year. That was the COVID year, and I didn't really get to see him much at all.
Right.
But I mean, there's a lot of admiration for like being same high school, big righty, kind of same path I'm taking. I mean, I followed pretty much every step of his minor league career. It's cool to see him. I mean, same pitching coach in Kevin Gunderson. Yeah, I love checking out all the starts. It's, yeah.
We got to get the two of you together to talk pitching. Maybe another podcast episode we'll make good. That happen. I know that you're very focused on helping your team win games and you focus on the mound, which is the right thing to do, and you shut out the scouts. Do you allow yourself in quiet moments to think about the draft at all?
I mean, from time to time, I'm really focused on winning a state championship with my team. That's my first priority. But I mean, every once in a while, I'll think of like, where am I faring in like this week's draft board, or like, what do scouts think of me? Just things like that. But I never dwell on it too much.
Someone who clearly pays attention, you know, the thing with high school pitching, especially high school right-handers, it's the high risk, high reward. Mm-hmm. Maybe that helps you sort of put it out of your mind, because you could be the best high school arm, and that's not automatically going to mean you're going to go where you should, because right. there are some teams that are just afraid of that sort of demographic.
I mean, that's always on my mind. I mean, it comes up in every meeting that I've talked with scouts. But I feel as if that risk all comes from injury, or maybe they don't play as well as they were projected to, but I feel like I have the stats and the mentality and the kind of the need to become the best that I possibly can. I think that it's hard to fail when I have all those on my side.
All right, Noble, this has been great. Thanks for having a conversation. Good luck in your last game, and we'll talk again soon.
Sounds good. Thank you.
We'll be right back after this.
Welcome back to the MLB Pipeline Podcast. Jim Callis, Jonathan Mayo, I'm Jason Ratliff. Thanks to Noble Meyer for taking the time to talk to Jonathan. And he was one of many players that you saw at the NHSI, Jonathan, and the most impressive?
Yeah. I think it's always fun. First of all, I love this event, mostly because, I mean, Jim and I have both gone to showcases and things of that nature, but this is a team oriented event, you know, and it's rare for us, and I, you know, to see these players in a sort of team setting. And it's great for scouts, because sure, they'll go and they'll see Noble Meyer pitching, you know, in Portland, and they'll see, you know, some of these other guys in Southern California, you know, against good competition in California, but they don't necessarily get to see them in this kind of environment where it's like constant, really good competition. And the stakes are high. This is you have to win four games to win the title, and to see how they rise to the occasion with that kind of spotlight is great. And with Noble Meyer, it was one of those situations where he came in as the best draft prospect at the event, and he performed like the best draft prospect at the event. I mean, he was really, really good. Consistently 95, 96, and you know, the stuff was just very, very good.
Is this the ideal scenario to see a pitching prospect? Because you just touched on this, but the fact that, you know, it's not a showcase where you're going to see a bunch of guys go one inning and air it out and, you know, just pitch an inning, and it is, And in this case with Meyer, in the specific case, he was facing, as you noted in the story on the top performers from the tournament, a powerhouse in Calvary Christian. So you're seeing him against, as you said, good competition and over more of an extended period than just coming out and throwing one inning.
Yeah, even like PDP league or you know, events like that where you may get see a guy for three innings, that's the most. So, yeah, seeing him go seven, he was still throwing 95 in the seventh inning. The breaking stuff, he's got a newer curveball along with the slider. He threw 26 of them with RPM north of 3,000. It's legit stuff. He only threw a couple of changeups, but he knows that he needs to keep working on it, and he does all the time. His knowledge, you can tell from the interview, his knowledge of what he needs to do is pretty amazing. He struck out 10. They did not barrel him up at all. And in fact, in the interview, sort of when I talked to him after his start, I thought it was a very telling. They had one inning where they had loaded the bases. They bunted him to death. I think they tried to bunt three times, including a bases loaded squeeze kind of situation that didn't work because they knew, they just were not getting good swings. And he came out the next inning and struck out the side. It was a statement inning, I thought, where he was like, all right, I think if there's any small knock, in talking to scouts afterwards, there's, a little concern about how the fastball will play. He is continuing to work on the life of his fastball, so it's clear that it's something that he knows he needs to adjust. But I'm not too worried about it. He's projectable. There's more in the tank. I think that it will continue to come. And again, this is probably a better team he faced than any team he's going to face back home in Oregon.
How does he compare to some of the recent top ranked high school pitching prospects over the past several draft classes? Looking back last year, Brock Porter was the top ranked high school pitching prospect at number 11, although Dylan Lesko was going into the season, then missed the season, ended up a few spots behind Porter at 14. Jackson Jobe in 2021 was number 7 overall, Mick Abel number 11, Matt Allen number 13 in 2019, and then back to Matthew Liberatore. The highest ranked high school pitching prospect in several years was number 4 overall. Meyer is number 16 on this year's list. But of course, those rankings are sort of relative. So kind of curious how he matches up to these other guys.
Well, I have a little sort of recency bias because I just saw Meyer. But, in talking to some of the teams that were there, couldn't not come away impressed by how he threw. We had Meyer at 16 when we did our top 100 in December. And I get the sense that he's probably going to be somewhere in that vicinity again when we re-rank. Now, Jim and I haven't gotten our heads together or figured that out, but talking to, some teams there, they felt that he sort of belonged in that range. Now, teams will sometimes sort of thinking about, well, where will he go in the draft as opposed to ranking purely based on talent. But I did have at least one team that picks in the top 10 that said they wouldn't consider him there. But from a talent standpoint, I probably put him somewhere in the 11 to 16 range, which is where he is now. Again, as you said, it's relative to the draft class. Lesko got hurt, otherwise he would have been much higher. So I wouldn't put him there, but I don't know. It's somewhat comparable to Brock Porter, somewhere in that vicinity, I would think, maybe not quite as overpowering stuff, but his feel for pitching and his knowledge of what he needs to do and the projectability all work in his favor.
Yeah, I think that's well said, Jonathan. I mean, it seems like, and we're going to obviously drill down very deep, like we had him ranked as the top high school pitcher in the draft back in December, right there with Charlie Soto and Thomas White. I think we're all in the same area. I think it, just, and again, more from casual conversations, I think he's the best high school pitcher in the draft. I mean, if the draft, like, you know, based on right now, I think he clearly is the best high school pitcher in the draft. But like you said, I don't think he's that guy who people are like, oh, we might have to take this guy in the top 5 or 10 picks. He's more of that mid first round type.
All right, Jonathan, tell us about some more names from the NHSI that we should know about. Some guys who stood out.
Yeah, I think the sort of a couple of hitters who I had next on the list are the ones that kind of stood out the most. One whom's not on our top 100, but whose name had come up when we were doing the list, and that's Ralphie Velasquez from Huntington Beach. And they won the NHSI title. This is the same high school that Nick Prado and Hagen Danner came from, and they had won the title back in 2016. He was very impressive with the bat. You know, the jury is still out as to where he plays. Depending on who I talked to, you know, they wouldn't let him catch at all. I did have enough people who said he showed enough where you'd send him out and let him catch and see what happens. But I think the bat is going to carry him. He went 6 for 8 over his first two games and drove in 5 runs, hit the ball extremely hard consistently. It's funny. I was thinking about him when we were talking about Adley Rutschman and the run grade, because Velasquez has not presented himself as like a super athletic catcher. He's kind of big, but he tripled in the NHSI and he ran very well. And it was noticed by scouts in running out the triple. You know, he's never going to be a speedster, but there may be a little more athleticism in there than people give him credit for. He made a couple of nice plays at first base when he played there a couple of games, but it's that bad. It's left-handed, good approach at the plate, and hits the ball hard. There's going to be some good power there. And then the other guy who was on our list is Trent Carraway from Jay Serra, also made it to the championship. And, you know, he went 7 for 16 overall, had a couple of doubles in the championship game. He consistently barreled up the baseball. Also a lot of top exit velocities over the course of time. I'll play third base. He's one of those guys, Jim, who's going to get dinged, and we don't need to get on our soapboxes now, but he's old for the class. So that's one of those, you know, that Jim and I like to rant about that from time to time. But that will be something people will be watching carefully, because he'll be 19 by the time, you know, when the draft comes around, and that for some teams models, but I felt the bat really, really played. He doesn't try to do too much. Both he and Velasquez, I think, stood out the most because with maybe one or two small exceptions, they never got outside of what their game plan was at the plate and never tried to, you know, let their swings get too big or anything like that. And that impressed me a lot.
You know, I was just noticing, going back to Meyer real quick, and him being the top ranked high school pitcher in the class at number 16. And we've only had one high school pitcher ranked in the top 10 over the past 5 draft classes. That was Jackson Jobe at number 7.
And Leska would have until right. He was, yep. Until he got hurt.
Yeah, would have, but wasn't. The previous 5 draft classes, there were 8 high school pitchers ranked in the top 10. Is this something of a trend? Is this a response to, you know, some of these guys not panning out and high school pitchers sliding down the ranks? What's going on here?
I feel like it's an adjustment. I don't think we've consciously said, hey, let's stop ranking high school pitchers high, but maybe we've become more cognizant of, I do think that's the riskiest demographic, just because pitchers get hurt and the high school guys are obviously further away from the big leagues than the college guys are. You know, we've had guys, we were like Riley Pint, who didn't pan out. You know, he's still, you know, making
still
a go of it.
Yeah.
I know he's still making a go. And Jay Groom, you know, was the number one on our list 1 year. And it's just, pitching's hard. And like, again, I don't think I know we aren't cognizantly saying, okay, let's just, you know, we have the same questions about the overall top 100 list, how there's a lot of hitters at the top. I just think when you fully believe in a hitter, it's easier to rank that guy over a pitcher you fully believe in, if that makes sense. Or at least that's how I feel personally.
Yeah, I mean, some of the guys from those five draft classes from 2014 to 18 who were ranked in the top 10, Brady Aiken, number one in 2014. Touki Toussaint was number eight in that same class. Highest ranked pitcher in that 2016 class, you mentioned Jim J. Groom and Pint. Braxton Garrett was number 10. Hunter Green was number one in 2017. Mackenzie Gore, number four in 2017. So yeah, kind of a mixed bag there. All right, let's talk some more draft, but let's switch to the college ranks. We had an absolute dandy of a pitching matchup, a doozy. What do you prefer, doozy or which is better, a doozy or a dandy matchup?
Dandy, I think.
I like dandy. Really? Yes.
Doozy has a slight, like, almost negative connotation to it. Yeah.
All right. But yeah, LSU Tennessee game just loaded with top draft prospects and got a Friday night matchup between Skeens and Dolander.
Thursday night.
Oh,
that's right.
Was it Thursday night?
Okay. It was.
Yeah, I was joking because a lot of people, all of the scouting industry, not all of, but there are a ton of people at the NHSI for the first day on Wednesday, that Noble Meyer versus Hunter Dietz matchup. Hunter Dietz was the lefty for Calvary Christian. And I was saying that USA Baseball should provide a shuttle bus to the airport because a ton of people went from there to that LSU-Tennessee matchup on Thursday.
Yeah, and Skeens was Skeens again. Got the better of that matchup. And at this point, would you say that he has bypassed Dolander as the top pitching prospect in the class?
Yeah, I think that's fair. And it's interesting because I think what we saw in that game is what we've seen from those guys most of the year. You know, they both kind of showed what they've shown pretty much all spring. And I know coming into the year, I used the line several times about how Dolander is probably the best college pitching prospect since Garrett Cole or Steven Strasburg, 10, 12 years ago. And Skeens has passed him. And you saw why. I still think Dolander's the number two pitcher and is going to go pretty high. But if anybody who saw the game, Skeens came out, he averaged, he went seven innings. He averaged, 98.6 miles an hour in the fastball. I think he was up to 101 or 102. He had 31% swing and miss rate with fastball, which is exceptional. He doesn't just throw it hard. He has a lot of carry to it. And, people have talked about in the fall, and one of the reasons we put Skeens at number four on our list was how good the slider had become. He's working with Wes Johnson, who, might be the best pitching coach in college baseball. I know LSU believes he is, who the Twins had made a big deal out of hiring, and then LSU hired him away from the Twins. So, like, Wes Johnson, very highly regarded. And Skeens' slider was ridiculous. I mean, it was interesting because he dominated the Volunteers with his fastball. He threw about 65% fastballs, and he only threw 18 sliders, but he got nine swings, eight swings and misses on the slider. He was averaging 86. Guys, made guys look really bad. He worked in a changeup that looked pretty good, threw a handful of curveballs. But he's been pretty much doing this every time out. And he's got, crazy stats. He leads the nation with 83 strikeouts. He's got a 0.81 ERA. He's walked eight guys and given up, I think, four runs in 44 and a third innings. Hitters are hitting 127 against him. It's crazy stats. And then, Dolander, what we saw for Tennessee was he was good, but it was kind of like what I saw at the beginning of the year when he went 4 2/3 against Arizona at the Desert Invitational, where he's been good, but he hasn't been great and he hasn't kicked his game up another notch. He averaged 96.5 miles an hour with the fastball. There was good swing and miss to it, not as much as Skeens. The slider, which was a wipeout pitch for a lot of last year for Dolander, he threw it hard. He averaged 88 miles an hour with the slider, but only got two swings and misses with it. It has not been as dominant. It's been merely good. It hasn't been a dominant slider. He threw a couple changeups and mixed in a couple curveballs as well. The command, which was really sharp last year, was just okay. He walked three, and I think he went 4 2/3 in this one, if I remember correctly. Again, threw 89 pitches, but yeah, I mean, like I said, the thing was great. If you watched that game, was you got to see exactly these guys have been doing this all year. Both of them. This wasn't like you saw Paul Skeens at his best or Dolander at his worst or vice versa. You got to see what guys have seen all spring. So I still think Dolander I still think Dolander's the second college pitcher taken. He's clearly number two, but there's no question Skeens has passed him.
And you still think that Dylan Cruz is the number one overall pick, or the number one overall draft prospect, I should say. There's a difference.
Well, we're talking to us, to LSU guys, and I'll throw in my 2 cents, and then Jonathan can throw in his. But like, you know, no team's ever had the top two picks in a draft. The closest it's ever happened was in 1978. Arizona State had Bob Horner go one and Hubie Brooks go three. In 2011, UCLA had Garrett Cole go one and Trevor Bauer went three. But you know, I mentioned last week how every time I look at Dylan Cruz, his batting average goes up, which is kind of hard. It went up again last week.
Did it go up again?
He's hitting 543. He's hitting 543 playing for an SEC team. Again, he's hitting 543. His on
batting
base.
Batting average.
Right, yes. Right. His on base is 664. His slugging is 947. He's got 29 walks. He's got 13 strikeouts. He's got almost as many home runs as strikeouts. And it's interesting because the track record of college outfielders atop the draft isn't great. I think it comes down to, you know, whatever, like the Pirates have the number one pick, right? The last time they had the number one pick, they cut a deal. They didn't make the pick based totally on talent. You know, if Marcelo Meyer or Jordan Lawler would have taken what Henry Davis took, those guys go 1-1 and they wouldn't. So like who goes number one and who the best player in the draft might are two different things. But I still, you know, like we were talking before, it's an interesting call, but like not, I mean, Paul Skeens is having a remarkable year. So is Dylan Cruz. So I like in most years, if a guy was doing what Paul Skeens is doing with the stuff he has, it'd be like, oh, like that guy's clearly number one. Like I think back to when Casey Mize was number one in 2018. Casey Mize wasn't dominating like this with this kind of stuff, but it was clear Casey Mize was going to be the number one pick. So most years, Paul Skeens would be like, oh, no question. But like Dylan Cruz is hitting 543. So it's going to be interesting. And like I said, you know, we haven't done enough to tell, you know, give a sneak preview who's going to rank number one on our list when we update it by the end of the month. I kind of feel like Jonathan Cruz and Skeens will probably be one and two, and Wyatt Langford's probably going to be three. I just don't know what order the top two guys will be in.
That makes sense to me, all of what you said. And, I mean, it may be a coin flip, really. I mean, not really, but you know, in terms of who we put one and who we put two. You know, if I were to decide right now, I'd probably go Cruz one, Skeens two. And as you pointed out, that doesn't necessarily mean that's how it'll happen on draft day. It's been a while since we've had a top pitching, college pitching prospect dominate this much in college. Even Garrett Cole, when he was clearly the number one guy.
It was Strasburg right. Numbers. Now, in Strasburg's, the crazy thing about Strasburg is Strasburg had, you know, comparable stuff at a time when Strasburg's stuff relative to his peers was better than Skeens' stuff is relative to his peers because guys are throwing hard and spin the ball better.
Right.
Like Strasburg's going to be tough to ever top. But yeah, I mean.
But also, he was pitching in the West Coast Conference, which, like, with all due respect, you know, he was dominant, but it was not the same level of competition that Skeens is in right now in the SEC. It's not. So I think that figures into it as well. So I, you know, it'll be very interesting to see. I think, you know, you mentioned that when the Pirates took Henry Davis, they did cut a deal. I don't think that they felt that there was a runaway number one. Now, maybe they still wouldn't have, they would have done what they did, but they really liked Henry Davis and he took the deal. I don't know that this will be the year to do that. This may be the year that they just take the best guy. We'll sort of see. There's a long way to go between now and July, but I think it's going to be very interesting to see what they do because there are two guys who are clearly the best players in the draft, and it's going to depend on what they feel helps the organization best. Both of those guys present as guys who won't take very long, presumably, to get to the big leagues.
Jim, you, in talking about Cruz, you talked about, you know, college outfield draft prospects not having a great track record, putting some names on that. Go back 10 drafts, look at some the top ranked college outfield prospect starting in 2014. Bradley Zimmer was number 10 in 2015. Andrew Benintendi was number eight. Number six in 2016 was Corey Ray. 2017, the top ranked college outfield prospect was Jaron Kendall. Adam Haseley was also a top 10 overall draft prospect. 2018, Travis Swaggerty. And then 2019, J.J. Bladé and Hunter Bishop. 2020, the top ranked guys were Garrett Mitchell and Heston Kerstad. So, yeah, I mean, kind of
similar. Paul Skeens is going number one, is what you're saying?
Well, I've been saying that to you guys over the past few weeks, but
that's just because he was on the podcast.
I wasn't, but that was not actually was not the point I was making. I was just
none of those guys hit 543 though. But no, it's interesting. I mean, I think the other thing that helps Cruz too is look. I mean, there's a lot of track record with this guy. You know, you go back to the pandemic year in 2020, where he was one of the top high school bats in the country, and you know, for whatever reason, he wasn't going to go in the first round, I think, and or he wasn't going to get paid what he wanted, so he pulled out of the draft. So I don't even think he was technically eligible at the end. But guys have been all over Dylan Cruz forever. I mean, I remember the first PDP league we ever went to, Jonathan, in 2019. Dylan Cruz is one of the headline players at the PDP league. So it's not like he's come out of nowhere and you're trying to figure out exactly what to make of him. But he's hitting 540. I noticed as I'm looking at college stats here, Jacob Wilson, who we talked about, you know, going back to Desert Invitational, I don't know, he's slipping, guys. He struck out five times already this year in 117 plate appearances. So it's like, I think last year was like 7.243, although he is hitting 465. So he's within 78 points of the NCAA Division I batting lead right now.
Yeah, you said none of those guys hit 543?
543.
543. Also, none of them were ranked number one overall, right? I mean, he is, you know, higher ranked than any of the guys who have not quite panned out as we
probably
expected
them to. I mean, and not just because of the 543, but I would think he's got to be the best pure hitter of that group. And it's not like his power is bad either, but he's probably the best hitter out of all those guys, which also helps him.
Okay, let's wrap up by answering a question from the mailbag. This comes from someone who we answered a question from recently. The Lizard King is my ace at Miami _or_nothing. Can you see PCA becoming a top 10 prospect by the time you guys update the rankings by All-Star break? Well, first of all, we're not gonna update the rankings by All-Star break.
Or I was thinking about it. Like the draft won't even have happened. So yeah, we'll just update them. Yeah, but, no.
By the trade deadline, we'll say.
I don't even know PCA if that's correct, Jason. Wait a minute.
Well,
around the re-rank. Oh my goodness.
Yeah, whenever it happens.
Like stuck on the semantics.
Let's nail down the date right now.
August 12th.
Fine. Do you see him as a top 10 prospect at that point? Pete Crow Armstrong being PCA?
I think he could, because you know there's two factors. One, we've talked about how so many guys are going to graduate. Gunnar Henderson, Corbin Carroll. I'm just looking at our list. Jordan Walker, Anthony Volpe, maybe Grayson Rodriguez at some point. Like there's going to be a lot of turnover on the list. And PCA had a ton of momentum last year. I mean, we all agree he's the best defensive prospect in the minor leagues. He's an 80s center fielder. As a guy who came out of high school and there are questions about how much impact he's going to have, he's gotten stronger. He's changed his swing. He drove the ball a lot last year, which was essentially his pro debut because he lost 2020 in the pandemic and got hurt six games into 2021. The one caveat I will throw out there, and we'll have to see how this plays out, is when he was in low A last year, he hit 354. He walked 22 times versus 33 strikeouts. When he got to high A, he was still a very good player, but he hit 287 and he struck out 69 times versus 14 walks in 63 games. And, you know, with him, I think he's ticketed for double A this year. If he doesn't tighten up that strike zone, he could get exploited a little bit. Like that's my big question about PCA right now is, can he get better control of the strike zone after that 5-1 strikeout to walk ratio in high A? So that's the biggest caveat. But I think from a tool standpoint and a performance standpoint, I think he could. I think he could jump into the top 10.
Yeah, I don't want to say he will because, you know, we need to sort of wait and see what happens. But I agree with that. And I think he's going to make adjustments. He's always been a very good hitter. maybe he got outside of his game plan a little bit when he got moved up. He's 21 for the entirety of this season. There's plenty of time. I think he's going to make adjustments, and I think we're going to look back and look at that sort of expanded zone, higher strikeout rate, all that stuff that we saw in high A. That's going to be an aberration, and he's going to make adjustments and work his way into at least the conversation for the top 10.
If you look ahead of him on the current list, there are six players currently in the big league. So you assume they graduate off. There are 22 players left ahead of him. There are also guys at AAA who we would expect to see in the big leagues. Now, whether they get enough time to graduate by the time the list is re-ranked is a question. But you have Francisco Alvarez, Grayson Rodriguez, Ellie De La Cruz is
Brett Beatty.
Oh, yeah, Brett Beatty, of course. Who else? We got Kyle Harrison at AAA, Taj Bradley at AAA, Bobby Miller at AAA, and that about exhausts the guys ahead of him. So that's another, half dozen. So you're looking at, if all those guys were to graduate off, he'd be around, 15-ish, just based on the current rankings. So he'd be pretty close.
Well, and I forgot. I mean, we tend to do a couple of adjustments, right? Before we do the full re-rank. So it might not even have to be the All-Star break if PCA gets off to a super hot start. And
he might have a better shot to get on there before we re-rank, because once we do re-rank, there could be some top draft picks that slot in ahead of him.
Dylan Cruz, Paul Skeens.
There you go. All right. Well, thanks very much for that question. Lizard King is my ace. And thanks to Noble Meyer for joining us. Thanks to everybody for listening. That's going to do it for this week's episode of the MLB Pipeline Podcast. Don't forget to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts so you don't miss an episode. If you're enjoying the show or have any suggestions, leave us a rating and a review. Thanks for listening. See you next week.